everyone. Welcome to Magical Baddies. I'm your host, Sophia.
And I'm Leah.
And this is the realest podcast on all things mystical, magical, and spiritual. So welcome.
Yay. I'm super excited. We had a little break, but yes, we're back and it feels really good. I'm really excited.
Yeah, and for those of you watching the YouTube, to be completely transparent, if my shirt looks weird, it's because I'm pumping right now. So shout out to all the moms doing more than one thing. So today is a really special episode because we're going to talk about Leah's bag, really. I'm going to interview you. This is a good primer for us to like eventually have guests, because I think that today's subject, decoloniality, which I have a hard time saying sometimes. I just want to add like an extra L to it.
Yeah.
Decolonize. So we're gonna let Leah get in her bag, because I personally, through our friendship, have learned so much about the subject through Leah. And it's never something that I feel is hard to grasp, or there's no like fear mongering within it. And I feel what I see a lot on Instagram and on social media is a little bit of this like us versus them and energy to it, that like I realized at some point, like, we're not, Leah and these people are not talking about the same thing. So Leah, what does Webster's Dictionary say about decoloniality?
I don't know. I honestly don't know what the dictionary definition of decoloniality is. Yeah, that's so weird that I've never looked it up before.
Yeah, that is weird. Okay, so why don't we go with this? Can you... So actually, I really want to know, before we dive into the difference between like this pop idea of decoloniality and what it is and what you study and what you present to the world in your work, I want to know how you came to the subject and came to really want to, you know, use your voice to let this idea float upon in the world.
Yeah. I came to this really organically. So I was, historically, I have been a teacher and worked in education. I was a classroom teacher, and the last school I worked in, I haven't taught in 8 years, but the last school I worked in closed down. The school was in Watts. It actually moved locations. It was in Watts and then Linwood and then Compton. But when I was in Watts, we had I taught 18 to 24 year old transitional age youth, people who had been pushed out of traditional school and were trying to come back and get their diploma. And we had a very distinct student body ratio that perpetually every year it was like 30% female or femme identified and 60% or 30 and 70. Math is not my subject. 70% male or masculine identified people. And in general, I would say the demographic was mainly cisgendered. But I was the only female staff person. And as such, I just developed a really strong bond with the female and femme students. And at one point, we developed gender groups in our school to have spaces, like closed spaces, where people could process their experience in their gender or gender-related experiences. And what I discovered through my experience, because, you know, at the time, like, you know, I didn't really identify myself as a woman. I mean, I knew that I was. I hadn't really delved into like gender identity much. I knew that I was a woman, but I wouldn't say that like studying gender was like my shit. Like I didn't know about it, but I was the closest thing they had. So I took it on. Sure. And what I discovered is that 100% of my students in that group had experienced sexual assault of some kind. Some experienced ongoing abuse, years and years of abuse. Some had been trafficked into sex work. Some had been, you know, some had just been catcalled, but most of them had some kind of physical experience. I think one of them had a baby that was a product of a rape situation. So they had, as a group, a tremendous amount of trauma. And as a teacher, I felt completely powerless. Like, I don't know, what can I possibly do for these people? Nothing. As an outsider in the community, as someone who doesn't live here, as, you know, for all intents and purposes, a white lady in a black and brown school, what can I possibly do? Nothing. And what I realized that was a common theme for my students was that they really had like no trust in their own internal knowing, in their own intuition. And so we started doing a lot of work around starting to develop your intuition, and not like in a witchy woo kind of way, but like in a real practical way of like, when something feels off, what do you need to do to listen to that? Or like when something feels like, you know, when you're getting a little bit of extra information that's not clear, but it's not evident, but like, you just know something, how do you trust that? Like, for instance, I had a student tell me that she was assaulted at the public library because she had gone there at like 8:30 at night, because you can still use the Wi-Fi if you sit outside the library, and she was trying to use the Wi-Fi on her phone. And she knew she shouldn't have been there because it was dark and she was by herself, but she didn't listen because she wanted to get on the internet, and she was assaulted by two men. And so this is not to say, well, you should have listened, it's your fault. That's not what this is. But like, how can you develop a really strong, comfortable relationship with your inner knowing? And they're like, ah, all right, tonight's not the night I go use the internet at the library, or I'm not going to go by myself, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And so I started exploring, like, how did this happen? How did like a whole community of women learn to abandon their self-trust? And what that took me down is like and for myself too, like I had to really, I didn't grow up being like supported to trust myself. Mm-hmm. In fact, I grew up in a household where like you only listen to your dad and he knows everything for you and that's it. So I went down this, you know, kind of rabbit hole of my own research, looking at the, you know, the way in which like our corporate government has established a culture through both, you know, social norms and media, and also policy and law, that demand that we yield our power to the state. So for example, you know, like I think it was in the 80s, there was like a lawsuit at McDonald's where someone got a cup of coffee and they spilled it on themselves and it was too hot. Burnt.
Yeah. And they burned themselves. Too hot on the side of the coffee. Yeah.
And they sued McDonald's for serving hot coffee. And it's like, if you take that lawsuit, it's kind of like a emblematic of like how our society is like, I can't think for myself. Like, tell me what I should think about this. Tell me how to have common sense, because we have already yielded that power to this greater society. So now we need like the legal infrastructure to like literally tell us what to think and how to have common sense. One of the things I would talk about with my students a lot was like, you know, we love to be critical of like European beauty standards. We love to really be critical of how bad and how toxic it is. But what we often miss in those arguments is that like somebody's literally making money off of our taught insecurity around our beauty, like the hair removal industry. I forget how to say it. Like, you can't say decoloniality, and I can't say the hair removal industry. Yeah. Like, the idea that your body with hair is so unattractive and unnatural that you should be hairless as a woman or a femme. And that now like there's anything from shaving to waxes, to creams, to laser, to like so many methods to remove hair. And it's simply for beauty. there's no other practical reason. If, you know, like, and I'm not blaming anyone, like, now that we know it, I still shave, you know, like, I, you know, whatever, I know it and I still do it. But somebody is making money off the fact that I'm insecure and I'm going to continue to buy these products and consume these things. So I just went down this rabbit hole of like, wow, us yielding our power, our inner knowing, not trusting ourselves is actually making somebody money. This is like a, this is a way bigger structure than just like, trust yourself, love yourself. Like that's not going to be the remedy here. There is something bigger happening. And it led me to create this workshop that I ended up doing at different colleges and different places called Decolonize Your Intuition, which now knowing what I know, I would never name a workshop that. But at the time I didn't know that was like my best guess. This was like 2015, 2016 when this came out. But it was really, I was trying to make the case for like colonialism as a structure is implanted so deeply in us that it has usurped our inner knowing. So that's really like what the roots of my path.
That's awesome. Like,
thank you.
Sorry, I was actually listening to your story. I didn't queue up a question. I do want to point out something though, because I think we have a very mixed bag of listeners, and you know, I'm the one that does all the stats and the data for our podcast.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I think is really cool about our podcast is who we are, right? And you and I, and both of us really felt like we were on the outside for a long time.
Yeah.
Probably still do. Yeah. And both of us, you know, the way we identify, because we're both mixed, I think gives us a very interesting perspective,
yeah,
and experience in this world, you know, because there's a part that's not belonging for real. And then there's also a part of us that can kind of mold into different communities.
Yeah.
But for those that are not Black and Brown or Indigenous, and Indigenous is a lot broader than Native American. I want to clarify to some people that when you are in those communities, regardless of your background, if you are not Black or Brown, you are white.
Yeah.
And I think that that is important to mention, because I think we're going to get into the race factor around decoloniality, which I feel like it has like a really heavy weight or stigma on the word that doesn't necessarily truly connect to its meaning and its purpose.
Yeah.
So do you want to get into that?
Yeah. I think like I learned that being a teacher, like I did my student teaching in South Central and in Compton. And I would say, you know, the majority of students in South LA and Compton in LAUSD are Black and Brown, the majority. And in those, in the schools where I did my student teaching, it was 100% Black and Brown. So Latino and African-American. And I think like, you know, one of the things thankfully that we did in my teaching, my teacher prep program at UCLA, is we had to really explore our positionality. And positionality is like a way of looking at identity that, one, it's intersectional. So you're looking at all of the intersections of your identities and how they cultivate the person that you are. But you're also looking at how those identities come together to position you in a power dynamic in your surroundings. So when I went into Compton, I saw my colleagues, my other classmates who were like white teachers or light-skinned Latino teachers going into to spaces with Black and Brown students, and the students would only see them as white. And white started to mean other things than just phenotype or skin color. It started to mean your proximity to wealth, your proximity to education, what kind of language you use, what kind of food do you eat. And so when people talk about white supremacy culture or white culture, it goes beyond race. It goes beyond simply a racial distinction to cultivate like the identity of whiteness. And You don't have to be white. In fact, that's why whiteness is so powerful, because it lives in bodies of color, even if, you know, like it lives in other people. It's so powerful because it lives in all of us in certain ways. I knew right off the bat, I saw people going in. It was like, I hate when people make analogies of like the education system, like war, like you're in the trenches. I hate that shit. Cause you're like, no, dude, I'm with kids. Like, but
no, I'm in education.
Yeah, exactly. But it did feel like I saw people going in like on the front line and just getting shot down by these students because they were calling them out as white. And then they would try to fight that and be like, actually, I'm da 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 da, or my, you know, I grew up in this community or that community or whatever. And I was like, I'm not doing that. Mm-hmm. That's not going to be my way to make, I'm not going to make a connection with students by me claiming like, watch me rap, guys. Look at how good I can rap. Like, I'm just like you. That's not going to be my way. So I didn't ever fight them. In fact, there were like, I didn't tell students that I was Mexican sometimes. I just like, I remember like, just like they'd overhear something and then I'd respond to them in Spanish or something. Or like, you know, I wanted to show and not tell, because mm-hmm. when we're told something, it's like, I don't know, like it's hard to believe something when someone says it, but if someone shows you, then it's like, okay, I can trust you a little bit. So I really adopted the understanding that like, you could be whatever you want when you're at home, Leah, but in this classroom, you're a white person mm-hmm. and you come with a lot of things that these kids do not have access to. And you can either recognize that and not run from it and not be ashamed or not play it down, or you can play it down and ignore it and then have a weird, inauthentic relationship. So,
Yeah, because I see a lot of arguments online, like, I have this, or my grandmother was that. And I'm like, it's not that. It's a socioeconomic and cultural thing. It has nothing to do. And when I mean culture, like lifestyle, it has nothing to do with your race.
Yeah.
And I think that when we put things out, like verbiage around some of these actions, like, get in touch with your indigenous roots, and people are like, well, I'm not indigenous, and it completely like deflates the purpose. So decoloniality, what does that like really mean to you, or like what you study, like how can you wrap that up in a package for listeners, and how can you also like explain, actually, you know what, let's start with like the pulp. I've been watching a lot of British reality, so I'm sorry. Let's explain like the pop idea of decoloniality, and then we'll get into like the true version of it, because I think that'll help people understand and differentiate the two.
Yeah, so I barely hear people use the word decoloniality. It's growing. But what I mainly hear is people use the word decolonize. Like mm-hmm. I had used decolonize your intuition, decolonize your mind, decolonize your diet, decolonize your spirituality, blah, 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 blah. What I think people mean when I see what they're doing, I'm making this, these opinions are those of Leah and Leah alone. I see people using that word to refer to some kind of going back. Like, how can we go back? I hear that word paired often with words like reclaim, mm-hmm. indigenize. And I am not mad at that. But I also hear that paired with, if you have indigenous roots, you can do that. And I have questions about that then, because who doesn't have indigenous roots on this planet? Whose roots have been obscured through the process of colonization and colonialism? Whose family trees have been completely obliterated from the record on purpose in order to make people either colonial subjects or colonial objects? Who truly can reclaim? And then for the people that are reclaiming, are you, what are you doing? Are you performing something that you saw that people do? Are you having the ontological experience that you believe your ancestors had? Like, I just wonder, I just have questions. So I'm saying this from a non-judgmental place. I understand that despite how people embody or take on the project of decolonization, whatever they think it means, they're coming from the same heart space that I'm coming from, that what exists is not good, mm-hmm. that we want something where we are not erased, where other ways of being that are not colonial are not erased, where there is equity for those that have been erased in the colonial project. I believe that we're coming from the same heart space. I believe that there are people, you know, I guess I could talk about myself. Like, my dad's family is Mexican. My mom's family is white. My dad's family, you know, comes from the Rio Grande Valley in Texas. And we're from that area before the Treaty of Guadalupe, which established the Mexican-American border. And half of my family was split into Mexico and half was split into Texas. And when I started looking, I mean, I can't find many census records, but I know that I found, like, my great grandmother was indigenous and she spoke an indigenous language. I know that. And when I found her parents, her dad was listed as a hunter. That was his profession in the 1880 census. So, like, I know that if I wanted to, that's my lineage too. But what would that mean for me to reclaim something that I would be constructing something out of nothing. And that doesn't feel right to me, for me. So I think that often when I see the word decolonize used, I don't actually think that they're talking about decoloniality. I think that what people are talking about is a social justice stance on bringing erased traditions and erased people back into the present. And what I've learned about myself in my own studies is that's just not my way. But I'm not going to say it's a wrong way, but it's just not my way.
And how do you, I think that's a really good way of saying, you know, in order, if we follow these like pop or these oversimplified ways of being, right? Because I think that people are oversimplifying them online. Yeah. I think it creates, really what they're saying is like create the story. And yeah. As humans, that I love a story.
Yeah.
We love a story, right? Mm-hmm. But like, is that story the reality? I guess it could be your reality. It could become your reality.
Yeah.
But I also find that there's a couple of things that stick out for me. And maybe my, you know, I think you had a really great way of articulating your questions. Mine might come off as judgy, but I would like to think this is a non-judgmental judgment zone. So, you know, how do these ancestral ways of being, regardless if they are real and researched or stories, because even if you research the totality of it, it doesn't necessarily mean that your ancestors took part in it, right? So how does that connect to your modern reality? Why does it feel so isolating? You know, I feel that when I see these things online, there's people like floundering and grasping at any way to connect to this idea. So that's saying, like, you know, people posting like, well, I have old Italian roots, or I have this. It's like something that's non-white to connect to this idea and validate their existence. And for me, I don't believe that spirituality is or should be departmentalize or compartmentalize.
Yeah.
And I think that creating this line, or, you know, it's that, what is that theory where if you start at one and you go so far, you end up on the other side? Like, yeah, it becomes like, whole horseshoe of, I can't think of the word, but
yeah,
I agree. It's like it's a social justice, and it becomes like we are better because we are connected to this idea, or we are connected by a race or whatever. And what I think it does is it scares a lot of people off.
Yeah.
One, two, it creates like no margin for failure, no margin for learning.
Yeah.
It's aggressive, like, you know, and look, as somebody who is non-white, you know, there's definitely times where I'm like, that's not my problem and I don't need to explain this to you, right?
Yeah.
I have that prerogative. I totally can.
Yeah.
But with that being said, I think sometimes a lot of these posts are like, you should know better, you should educate yourself, you know, and it becomes a racial theory, and it's not about that.
Yeah.
From what I understand, from what I've learned from Leah, and I think that a lot of why Leah and I are friends is we have a lot of things in common in the way that we see spirituality, and that it's less about that and more about taking the saran wrap off of your spirituality and just letting the shit pour out.
Yeah.
And I think that
what
you are articulating is that like this control that the government, then colonizers and whatever has created, has become the saran wrap.
Yeah.
It becomes our programming.
Yeah.
And so how do we deprogram? And I see that a lot too in pop psychology. I see that a lot in what we're talking about now, like deprogram. Yeah. And it really truly boils down to, not to overly simplify this because, you know, I know you go to school for this, but it boils down to simplifying, like the most complex things really come down to simplification. So that's my take on it, and I feel that whenever I say, one of my favorite things to do, by the way, because this is getting a little heavy, is to screenshot these posts and send them to Leah and go, thoughts?
The DMs are private, you'll never see what's in there.
no
So really quickly, I keep referring to social justice, and you might think, people out there might think that social justice and decoloniality are the same thing, and I don't recognize them as the same thing. Just to put it real, like, simply, to me, social justice is an attempt, it's a project to develop and bring equity into a system that is actually inherently inequitable. So, like, social justice might ask for us to close the wage gap between men and women. But social justice is not addressing, why do we have to labor at all? Who invented that? Why do we have to spend our lives laboring? Decoloniality to me is looking at the system itself is broken and what else is possible. So, for example, one of the examples that I always try to give people that's like, I think a simplification but will help, is like, when Jay-Z and Beyonce were like the spokesmodels for Tiffany, like that was like a huge moment because these two Black creators were now the face of this incredibly elite luxury brand. So now we have, you know, people who in our country historically were enslaved are now the models for wealth and beauty and power. It's aspirational, but nothing about that ad is looking at, where do the diamonds come from? What indigenous people suffered at the hands of the diamond mine industry? what's happening to the countries and the land that these things are being, you know, extracted from. So like, while yes, we can say, oh, representation matters, like there's equity in this system of capitalism that these, you know, these African-American creators are now reaching this equity, we're not looking at the other side of the planet that on whose back is this standing. And decoloniality asks us to look at the whole thing. Does that make sense? Is that like kind of clear?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
I think
it's very simple what I just said. It's essentializing, really.
Right. And I think that mm-hmm. it's important to note that even though we're bringing up social justice and we're bringing up decoloniality, and even in that, in this whole Beyonce, Jay-Z, Tiffany's thing, we're not saying one thing is better than the other, or we only believe in one thing or whatever, but we're trying to break down the difference between the two.
Yeah.
Because I think that isolating one or the other and keeping them separate only further isolates the ideas and further isolates maybe a group of people or land or whatever. And I think that's important to say, because there's definitely
I actually do. I don't fuck with social justice. Yeah. I don't do social justice anymore. I'm not interested in it at all. Yeah. But that's okay. But like, that's why I said these are the views of Leah and Leah alone.
Yeah. I'm trying to like process that, because I feel like, okay, let's see it in this way. I know you don't, because you post about that a lot, or not a lot, but a decent amount.
Yeah.
However, I think what has to be clarified and in knowing you is that you definitely say like, these things are fucked up, or that's fucking stupid.
Yeah.
So let's clarify that.
Yeah.
Because you can definitely say like, I think people can say that and then take it as like, so you don't think this whole shit is fucked up, you know, like.
Yeah, no, that's not at all what I mean at all. There we go. I no longer orient toward a social justice agenda. I orient toward a decolonial agenda. It's not that I'm just like, fuck social justice, let's go party. No, I mean I said we're definitely gonna party, but like I have made the leap to like, social justice is just not enough for me. It's just not enough for some element of the inequity to be rectified and then there be suffering all over the rest of the planet. That's just not enough to me. And part of it is like what you were mentioning earlier, to me is like, we need to learn about ontology. The reason why some of these posts are so shaming or judgmental when they're using the word decolonize, like you need to do this, you need to do that, is because those posts are using the same strategies of colonialism to try to get across their message. So it's like, well, what exactly are we changing then? And I saw this happen really clearly in 2020, after the murder of George Floyd and the uprising for Black Lives, and all of the white people who were suddenly in a frenzy trying to like figure out how to not be racist. And all of the things I saw, so like in social media and like op-ed pieces, shaming white people essentially for being in a white body. And to me, it just, that does not, I get what you're doing, but what I see you doing in this racial justice movement is using the strategies of colonialism to try to create racial justice. One, race cannot be deconstructed if we don't deconstruct capitalism. The structure of capitalism requires a labor market, and our labor market in the West was created through race-based classifications. Who are the people that are most in prisons right now? Black and brown people. Well, guess what prisons are? They're money makers. Mm-hmm. Like, who are the people in the labor markets? They're low income people, like people in physical labor markets. They're low income people, and they're disproportionately low income people of color versus low income white people, disproportionately compared to the bigger population of both of those racial groups. Like our economy requires that. So there is no way, in my opinion, that we can have racial justice and not completely shift the way we orient toward economy. But the racial justice movement was not willing to look at that. It wants justice within capitalism. It wants the wage gap to be closed. It wants, so I just saw, you know, going hearkening back to the Audre Lorde essay of like, the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house.
Yeah.
When we use those strategies, and this is the rub though, because we don't really know that we're even using those colonial strategies.
Sure.
Especially when we use words like decolonize, we're like, I think in my head that I'm against colonization or colonialism, but then I will do the exact same thing. There's an Indigenous writer and scholar from Canada named Leanne Simpson, and she's speaking to her Indigenous students, but she says, shame is a tool of settler colonialism. It teaches us to hate our bodies. And while she's speaking to her Indigenous students, I would say that that's true for all of us. It's a tool of settler colonialism. Shame is like a strategy that we use on each other. The government uses it on us. The society uses it on us. Like, I was just talking to somebody who, we were talking about the gang injunction law in California, that like, if you commit like some kind of crime, put quotes around crime for the audio people, and you also are affiliated with a gang, so maybe the gang is a totally separate thing from the crime that you've committed. Mm-hmm. The gang injunction will add another 7 years to your sentence, no matter what it is. So if you like steal a piece of pizza from 7-Eleven, but you're also a known gang member, you're going to get whatever the, you know, 6 months for stealing or whatever, plus seven years. So right now the government is creating a stigma around your identity that is going to follow you forever. Like, shame is a tool that is used to like control us. And so when I see people posting things about decolonize this and that, and they're invoking shame, or they're invoking control, or they're invoking like the methods that have been used by colonization or colonialism for a long time, I know, okay, that's not what I mean when I talk about this, when I study this stuff. I don't mean that.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So that's what we mean when Leah gets in her bag. I had to figure out how to get you in there.
I go off. I can talk.
No,
forever.
It's good. Yeah. That's why I was like, let me think about this. How do I word this so she gets in there? I do want to say, you know, as you're speaking, especially when it comes down to social justice and this like pop idea of decoloniality, is the thing that always clicks in my head is nothing is truly cruelty free. Like world. Like, I just feel that in a lot of these posts that I see, it's like, you know, reclaiming our Indigenous roots, doing all of this and trying to dismantle an idea with what you're saying, like with the same ideas that are given to us and created around us. So we're taking from our environment and we're taking from our experience and then placing it on another group or another experience. Because you are trying to de-cruelize your situation doesn't mean that cruelty is not placed on another.
Yeah.
So no matter how you do it, even if it's like reposting because you like the idea, you know, nothing is cruelty free. Somebody is going to get hurt somewhere. Right.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of times in social justice, there's a huge isolation and a cruelty placed on others. And I know a lot of it's saying like, well, others are cruel to us, so we're going to be cruel back. But like at some point, where does the pattern end? And you can't end the pattern. Yeah. Like you said, you can't end the pattern with the master's tools. And so I think it on a spiritual level, because I can only speak from a spiritual level. I can speak from many levels, but in terms of decoloniality on a spiritual level, from what I understand, from what the Akasha has told me, from everything that I have learned since COVID, is the saran wrap has to be ripped off and we have to start thinking outside of the box to create new ideas and new motives and new ways of being. Yeah. And that sounds so huge. And it is a huge task. It's not as simple as going back to when times were simpler, because frankly, times were not simpler back then either.
Yeah.
And I think that you know, it really comes down to something that I learned while working at a law firm. We see a lot online, like the law of attraction, the law of nature, like all these various laws, especially in the spiritual container. Yeah. And when I worked at a law firm for a little bit, which I always wonder why I worked at a law firm, because it's really not part of my personality, but I am a Libra sun, so maybe that makes sense. But when I was there, one of the attorneys said to me, law is not a science, it's an art form.
Yeah.
And the best attorneys are the ones that can take that law and flip it upside down or dance yeah. around it, not yeah. the ones that adhere to it. And yeah. I want people to like pause around that, because I think there's a lot of quote laws, and we
yeah.
create these like vessels around these ideas of our reality, and truly spiritually what reality is saying yeah. or the universe is saying, because it's a non-reality yeah. reality, is to like
yeah
fuck it all, like rip yeah. it apart
yeah.
And so
yeah.
you can't do that when somebody is telling you, you have to do this, you should be doing that.
Yeah.
And that is kind of, to me, as somebody who is not, does not study decoloniality, a red flag in some of these posts.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, just in what you're saying too right now is like, just to apply the concept of a law to all of creation is colonial. Like, we do it, we talk about it, but like, there's no law of attraction. No. There are patterns of the way we see, the way we observe existence to be governed, but we only know things like laws. So it must be this way, so it's a law, so let's apply that concept. Anyway, off the topic though, yeah, what, something that like early, so I've used my Akashic practice in like concert with my development of my decolonial lens, because it's really helped me. Because what has happened for me is that reality has revealed itself to me. It's like I now can see through the colonial project. I can see when something is colonial. I can see decolonial options. I can like, I approach things with a decolonial lens, not all the time, but like I'm growing it all the time. But for me, that meant that like reality had to dissolve and I had to rebuild it as something else. And so I relied on my Akashic practice very heavily to, for the, like the personal support of like, this is scary, what's happening. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I remember my records telling me is that, cause I asked about like, why are people so critical of love and light? You know, when like people offer thoughts and prayers or love and light when something tragic has happened. And they're like, because if they really knew, he's like, they're not, they, he's like, if people really knew, or why are people critical of when people offer that? And they're like, if people really knew the power of love and light, they would understand that that's not, they're not talking about the same thing.
Yeah.
Love and light is all there is. It is the center of the war is a place of love. It, you just don't understand what love is. So you think yeah. that it's void of love. And that really like shook me. The like, if we really knew the power of love, it's present in the most, in the darkest moments, it's present in the worst moments. And if we could embody that, we would learn how to be relational with each other, and we wouldn't need shame. We wouldn't need control. We wouldn't need the master's tools to keep the status quo. We would know that relationality, our connection to each other and the planet, is the thing that will allow like a harmonious way of being, a living system to emerge. But we don't know it because we are deeply colonial. We're, yeah. we're, you know, and I'm not blaming anyone, but yeah. Yeah.
Awesome. I think that was a really good way of segueing into segueing
penguin
into the spiritual aspect of it.
Yeah. Should we save
Should
we save the spiritual aspect? Part two?
I think so. Yeah. So I think that this was a really good intro to decoloniality, because it's a lot. There's a lot more to it than we can cover in one episode.
Yeah.
And I think that it's really important in this day and age to really get the raw reality of what it means and how it can be applied and what it is. So we're going to do a part two and really dive into it.
Yeah. And I'd like to share like a definition for it, because we haven't really done that, and I think it's a slippery word to grasp onto, so I would like to give people that in the next episode.
Yeah, so we're really going to define decoloniality in the next episode. And I think we're going to try, I'm speaking without talking to Leah, I think we're going to try to release that episode a little sooner so it can go hand in hand and people can really dive in and not forget how this goes. So we're going to try to make that happen because we usually release once a month. So I'm going to try to get it out quicker.
Okay.
But with that being said, I think that that's a good way to start with decoloniality. And I want to thank Leah for all of her work and all of her courage in saying, like, and just being who she is and putting this work out, because I know that what she does and what she says and what she posts does rub a lot of people the wrong way, because the masses have an idea of what it is. And that in itself is decolonial, I believe. And I think that that is one of the reasons why she's so fucking awesome, because a lot of us can have these ideas and have these thoughts and have these beliefs, but are so scared of being looked at like we have three heads. So thank you, Leah, for doing that and for being
That is just so kind. And I receive it and I accept it and I won't reject it, even though compliments are very difficult. Thank you so much, Sophia.
You know what I read is that somebody said, in terms of compliments, is I'm giving you your flowers. Whether or not you want to take them is up to you.
Yeah, that's real. I mean, that's a good one.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to like receive more. Like I wouldn't want you to give me flowers and they just go to waste. No.
I want flowers. I want lots of flowers. Yeah, I know love you flowers.
Do. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Hi, everyone. Okay. We want to thank you guys for goyles, gals, goys, all of them, friends, for joining us and always listening. And please continue to give us a 5-star rating and comment or send us messages. It really helps, honestly. Yeah. Like, I'm really blown away by the amount of listeners we've had in just a few episodes. And I, from the bottom of my heart, want to thank everybody, because for somebody who is constantly looking for meaning in her work, it helps and it's awesome. Yeah. And I really love this podcast. So thank you all for doing that. We do have a Patreon. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, we're going to plan our first Patreon meetup
live hang soon. Yeah.
So you should join that.
Yes. And we both have the link in our Instagram bios. So at Crystal of Altamira, at Divine Void Sophia, you can just click right on and join us. And it's only $5 a month. So, that's nothing at this point. That's what my iTunes takes out. And I don't even notice it most of the time.
Yeah. iTunes.
That's or gone, iTunes, girl. Apple. iTunes. I'm so old.
That's my Zynga is like but go get your Tamagotchi, it needs you.
My Fitbit. Awesome, so thank you all and we'll see you soon in the next episode.
Bye everybody.
Bye.